Anthony Jack is a professor in the Department of Cognitive Science at Case Western Reserve University in the United States of America. Trained in a multitude of disciplines, Anthony approaches consciousness from experimental psychology, philosophy, and neuroscience. In this interview and discussion, he addresses the problems found in the very definition of consciousness, the problems found in explaining consciousness in purely physical terms, and the problems found in explaining consciousness in purely non-physical terms, and describes a potential remedy for studying consciousness without certain problems. My initial starting point to you, Anthony, would be obviously you've got a multidisciplined approach in this area with a background in experimental psychology and philosophy as well. Consciousness, a very open-ended debate, many definitions. How do you think is the best definition for us to start thinking about consciousness?
I think this is exactly the right point to push on, because I think we have to be very careful about how we're approaching this broader issue, right? So for me, actually, to make the move, what is consciousness and let's have a definition, is already starting too quickly. And the reason is that consciousness, that way of coming at it, assumes consciousness is a phenomenon which has a certain physical nature that can be unpacked, or maybe a certain supernatural nature that can be unpacked. I prefer to back up a little bit and say, what's the problem of consciousness? Right? What's the problem that has classically concerned philosophers, and we can go back to, you know, Leibniz and the birth of the scientific revolution, when the thought that was being articulated was, we got this new way of dealing with the world, of explaining the world, which is science. And, of course, back then they were very influenced by an industrial view of the world. So you could think of a factory, a machine. That was their metaphor for a machine. Now we use computers more as our metaphor for a machine, the brain. And so the thought was, well, it's nice. We can think of thinking as being the operation of levers, as mechanical operations. But when you do that, you seem to leave something out. Seem to leave out the experiential aspect of it. And that's at the core of the philosophical problem of consciousness. And the standard way of responding to that has been to say, okay, well, now what do we do with that thing that's left out? Can we fit it into the physical realm really after all, even though it seems tough to talk about in mechanical terms? Or do we have to say, well, okay, it's mechanical in a very special way, like quantum theory, or do we just give up on any physical explanation and say, no, it's so different from that, we're just going to have to say that we're going to have to go to some sort of dualistic position, whether that's a substance or a property dualism. And I think all of that's a mistake. The first error was just to go there like that, because you can acknowledge that a scientific description leaves something out of our understanding of the mind, without thinking it's a phenomenon that is even suitable for explanation in physical terms. And that's really where I go with my work. So with my work, I show that when we engage with understanding how physical mechanisms work, we use a completely different set of brain regions, and we actually suppress a set of brain regions that we use for an interpersonal engagement. And when we interpersonally engage with someone else, then we actually suppress this set of regions which is essential for understanding physical mechanisms, right? And we engage this completely different set of regions. So I really think the problem of consciousness, the philosophical problem, is about different ways of understanding. It's not really about there being a phenomenon that needs to be captured in the world that is perhaps or perhaps not distinct from standard physical information processing phenomena.
This gets edited afterwards, so don't worry about any mistakes, having to leave for an emergency, hopefully not. And I record your introduction about who you are separately. Great. Well, my initial starting point to you, Anthony, would be obviously you've got a multidisciplined approach in this area. Obviously, with a background in experimental psychology and philosophy as well. Consciousness, a very open-ended debate, very long debate, many definitions. How do you think is the best definition for us to start thinking about consciousness? If there's a basic problem in terms of trying to understand a phenomenon of consciousness in the first place, then what are some of your ideas about trying to understand consciousness in different ways? How would you approach this path?
I very much applaud the idea of focusing on a definition. And I think one of what we really have to be careful about is to define what we're trying to explain, right? Whether that be, in my case, my central interest is I'm trying to explain the origin of the philosophical problem of consciousness. For some people, they want to explain a phenomenon that's very important to understand, for instance, which is the difference between waking, sleep, and death. Okay, I mean, there's a very good question, right? And this is something that's clearly something that you can address in terms of physical mechanisms, right? It's a great question to address in terms of physical mechanisms. We can also address it in terms of what experientially are those like, where there's at least something very vivid experientially that it's like to be awake, something a little harder to grasp when you're asleep, and of course nothing really to grasp when you're dead. So, you know, there are those two different approaches. I think we have to be careful to define the problem and clarify how we're coming at it. Are we coming at this as a physical phenomenon in the first place? In which case, you know, that sets up the whole approach and what the phenomenon is you're going to study. If you're setting it up as something to understand at an interpersonal level, a sort of shared experiential level, then you're setting this up as something that is just belongs to a different realm from physical explanation.
As you're alluding to there, are they necessarily at that point, even though you've made a distinction, are they necessarily mutually exclusive? A lot of people obviously think that consciousness, including the interpersonal agency level between two conscious minds, can still be clearly reduced to a physical level, as well as the experience and sensation of consciousness. Some extremists here would say it's consciousness is an illusion. Do you think we can collapse the two, or they're necessarily mutually exclusive, that we can't do a physical mechanistic explanation of consciousness and then have that framework to account for the interpersonal contact of consciousness?
Okay, so that's a great question. So first of all, I back off a little bit about saying consciousness, right? Because there's this equivocation in there. Like, I mean, do you mean alertness? Well, of course we can have a physical explanation of alertness, right? If you want to say, can we have a physical explanation of what it feels like to be, you know, so-and-so, or to have this emotion or whatever? No. Just flatly, no. I think it's quite... I mean, I think the neuroscience is extremely suggestive. I wouldn't say that it's an absolute slam dunk. That's just a different type of understanding. Now, that said, obviously when someone, say, is in love, right, then they are in a physical state and they are experiencing a certain sort of experience that we can talk to each other about and we can communicate with through artworks. So there are possibilities for bridging. So, you know, we can find out things about what happens and what guides the process of being in love. And that can give interesting insight into that experience. But it isn't the same as the experience, right? I mean, to grasp the experience is to rely on an extraordinary ability we have where we can use our empathetic imagination to go beyond and to build upon, but go beyond our own actual experiences to grasp the experience of another, right? Something which in some sense seems impossible, right? Because that experience exists outside us. We have no direct access to it. And yet that is a sort of human miracle. That is maybe one of the things that is so well developed in the human and not in other animals, the basic parts of it in other animals, that we have this kind of empathetic imagination to put ourselves in someone else's shoes. But that just that act of empathetic imagination is just fundamentally different from thinking about what the mechanisms are that are going on in their brains. As long as you distinguish them, you can say, oh yeah, but look, here are these parallels. The experience of this emotion has these features, and actually we can look at the science, we can say, oh yes, that's why it has these features. You know, the fear involves focusing down your attention, and we can give a mechanistic story of that, and then you see it reflected in the reports that happiness involves a broadening of your attention, and we can see that in the mechanisms that are working, and we can appreciate it when we have this intersubjective understanding, or when we study the reports that people give. So we can see these parallels, we can see these bridges between them. But, you know, understanding those mechanisms isn't going to make you understand what it means to be happy. It's just a different thing to do.
Essentially saying that we can have a physical mechanistic explanation of certain brain states, but they don't necessarily lend themselves to fully explaining the qualia aspects of it, which are slightly different. With this kind of stuff in mind, what are your opinions on some of the different theories are currently on the table, either contemporary terms or historically, about different approaches to consciousness? There's a whole mismatch starting from extreme physicalism to quantum mechanics and consciousness and panpsychism to neo-interpretations of the classic dualism debate. How do you plot these out in your market? Do you find any of these useful? What are the pros and cons of some of these approaches?
First of all, I just want to say, you know, I kind of agree with what you were saying about, so you can't get at the qualia part, but I want it all to be put in inverted commas. That is, to even call them qualia is to start putting them in a domain of something, you know, as a property, right? That's the idea of qualia. It's a property which doesn't happen to be or doesn't seem to fit with a standard information processing or physical account or representational account. But that, to me, it's like, that's fine, but it's all in inverted commas, because there are no qualia. There's just a different way of relating to the same phenomenon, right? So I'm in no way am I a metaphysical dualist, right? That is, if you want, what you're going to explain with a framework that looks like science, right, is going to be the physical world, full stop, right? But there's this whole world that matters more to us than that, actually, right, which is this world of what is morally right and wrong, what, you know, the other people's pain, making connections with people, right? And that shared intersubjectivity is just something, it just belongs to a different realm. Right. You had an early way of putting this, and you said, what are the strengths and weaknesses of a physical explanation of consciousness? And basically, that it will never be able to communicate what the experiences are like. Right. So it just doesn't speak to one type of understanding. What are the strengths and weaknesses of a non-physical explanation of consciousness? Well, I think that there's something good about a non-physical explanation of consciousness. And that is that the people who are driving towards this kind of thing have seen something. They have seen that the physical doesn't provide a complete understanding, right, of the mind. And I applaud them for that. Although I think that their strategy then, the way they take that insight, is fundamentally mistaken. Because actually, by now appealing to a, quote, non-physical explanation, what they're really doing is they're trying to come up with a way of capturing this missing part from the physical with a model that looks just like physical explanation. This is a mistake, I believe. So I believe that this path actually solidifies the problem, right, which is a problem of understanding that's rooted in our basic neurobiology, right, that these two types of understanding are in conflict with each other. And that by arguing for a dualistic account, a metaphysically dualistic account, whether it be property or substance dualism, they're basically just solidifying the problem, right? They're now making it so they've just tried to jam the square into a circle. They're trying to give an explanation with the wrong form of explanation. So I think that while there's something very promising about the pull towards dualism, because it's a recognition of the inadequacy of materialism to capture all of human understanding, then the explanatory approach is fundamentally mistaken. And then you say, well, you know, what would be interesting way to go forward? I think the most important point to me, which I'm building the case for, and I'm sure not everyone is convinced yet, right, is just to establish this point that there are these two basic types of human understanding, these two ways of coming at explaining the mind, right? And then I think there's a lot of work to be done, if one acknowledges that, on just how sharp the division is between these and what sort of bridging explanations, what sort of bridging contact can be done. And in fact, you see that kind of work go on in psychology quite a lot, where there is bridging explanations. In fact, I think Dennett's consciousness explained, while laughable because he thinks he's explained it, he thinks the trick to explain it is just to say it's all physical, and I think this is a fundamentally mistaken view of his. Actually, what it ends up doing in that book, with all these wonderful examples he gives, like the person who has a sensor on his tongue and that helps him see, and these sorts of things, is that he does end up with a bunch of bridging explanations that do enrich our phenomenological understanding of each other by, you know, giving it extra grounding in a scientific understanding of what is constraining that phenomenology. So I think he's actually, in what he writes about, he's done a marvelous job of doing bridging. I don't agree with his meta description of the project, which is a very reductive in nature. I think he's failing to realize that there's always something still that's left out.
Just going back to the point about how those that propose a non-physicalist explanation of consciousness are to a certain extent just presenting a mirror problem of the physicalist approach, and you're saying that in a scientific materialist aspect we can get one understanding of consciousness but not another. With that in mind, are you happy just to leave that as it is, or is there other stuff you want to go moving forward with bridging exercises? So are you happy just to have a scientific explanation of what different aspects of the brain states do and are correlated to a certain extent with notions of love, but they can never fully address or explain the feeling of love? Are you happy just to keep that division as it is, or are you hoping for a bridging of a meta theory in the future? Any ideas on that?
Yes, I mean, certainly. Okay, so it's a great question. And in fact, that's a point I hit on quite a bit in this paper that's just coming out, which is kind of my big summary of this position. You know, I'm not happy with it, right? I mean, it's not that I'm happy that there is this division in our understanding that I believe there is. You know, I think it causes a lot of intellectual problems. I just don't think that denying that it's there is a productive strategy, right? So, I mean, I kind of join with the idea that this is, which is shared by many physicalists, and you can hear their irritation sometimes. You can hear Dennett's irritation quite often. But I just think he's got the wrong target for his irritation, right? I mean, the irritation shouldn't be with the dualist who Dennett thinks, you know, come on, I once had a conversation with him on the tube in London where he was telling me they were just being dishonest. I mean, I think he's kidding himself. They're not being dishonest. They see a problem, right? And a problem that he's kind of in denial about the inadequacy of physical explanation. I also see it as a problem, right? So I'm very interested in working on that problem. Yes, I'm very interested in how then do we bridge between it. And in particular, I think that this problem really lies at the core of ethics, and that's really where a lot of my work is going. So why do I say that? Well, for one thing, because we have a nice set of studies which show that you tend to believe more in dualism if you have more empathetic concern, and you tend to be more of a physicalist if your personality profile is more similar to a psychopath, right? So that's, you know, that's some empirical data that suggests that this relates strongly to ethics. But I mean, I think it also, if you think of many of the classical philosophical problems of consciousness, like the philosophical zombie, I mean, the problem of the philosophical zombie is really very closely parallel to fundamentally important social phenomena like dehumanization. So what you're talking about, essentially, when you're imagining a philosophical zombie, is a phenomenon that has happened in the world many times, right? So many times have one set of people enslaved another and talked about them as if they didn't really have experiences. There's a wonderful quote in a book by Raymond Gaita, which says, you know, we feel pain, and then in inverted commas, they feel pain, right? It looks like pain, right? And yeah, the behaviors are similar, but it's, you understand, it's not pain, right? It's not what you and I have, right? And so you can disregard their suffering. And I think this is really what this problem is about. It's about whether we are adopting a physicalist, a scientific approach, which is essentially detached, right? And in that sense, cold, right? And inhuman, right? Or versus whether we're taking an approach where, which is, as I said, sort of intersubjective, where we're allowing ourselves to think of the other as sharing an experiential world with us. And that's so fundamental to ethics, I think, and to both to atrocity and to how we can build a good life for ourselves and others. So that's really very much the direction that I'm interested in pushing further forward on, is how these philosophical problems end up really shedding really quite rich light on issues that are very socially important. For me, that's going to be the main focus for the next 10 years, I think.
And talking about the next 10 years, you've outlined some of the ambitions of your project in terms of the theoretical framework for it. What do you think are some of the other important issues that will help push this discussion further in the next decade? So what are some things that need to be resolved or clarified or at least brought to light in this area?
I guess it would help to know the audience. But if there's going to be quite a few philosophers in the audience, then I think that a really important problem is understanding the nature of the relationship between metaphysics and ontology. So what do I mean by that? Well, I mean, I think that we cannot avoid that from the experiential point of view, there are some things that are fundamental, right? Like certain basic emotions, like persons. Persons is just a fundamental part of our ontology from this empathetic way of understanding the world. And if you think of the sort of Jaegwon Kim model of explanation, where the personal kind of like fits in at this level in a hierarchy of explanation, right? So you sort of have the personal and then the subpersonal, but it's all in a single hierarchy, right? That's not going to work, right? I mean, the personal isn't in the same hierarchy as the hierarchy of physical explanation, right? It belongs to a different species of explanation. And these two species of explanation, you know, they each have their own ontologies, right? And so I think that philosophers, for very good reasons, have wanted to aim at simplicity, harmony, the idea that we will have one, you know, universal metaphysics, one universal ontology that's going to explain everything. Okay, that I promise you will not work. I mean, I know right now that people may feel the evidence isn't there to convince them. I mean, they can read my paper, whatever, but it won't work. So they're going to have to really rethink what is the project here, because if you try and make the project something of cramming everything into this one unified metaphysics or ontology, you're going to fail. And I think one strategy that I kind of incline to, although this isn't really my area to work on metaphysics and ontology, I'm really more a scientist than a philosopher, but I'm inclined to say, let's make metaphysics about the physical world. So let's just say that metaphysics is going to be the ontology of the physical world. But let's just accept that there is going to be another ontology that is tremendously important, if you like, to the ethical world, right, to the human world, to the human in that sense of humanism and the humanistic disciplines. That's just going to have a different ontology, and we're going to need to divide those out. So I think that's a fundamental sort of problem for philosophers, and I've spoken to a few, and you know, some of them see it and are, you know, have that concern. But I think at the moment the field is still dominated by people who think you've got to strive for the single metaphysics and unified metaphysics and ontology, and that's really what drives a lot of people to dualism, right? Is that kind of thought. But you know, I think what goes against that is that our brain is not some, you know, magical entity that can do absolutely anything. It was something that evolved with a bunch of constraints, and I think that the evidence I've assembled makes a strong case that that evolutionary trajectory involved separating out two ways of thinking, and both of which are really quite sophisticated and developed. I mean, you can think of C.P. Snow's talk of the two cultures, right? And you see this all the time, that you have the people who are developing one way of thinking versus the more scientific. I think our culture is very scientific and analytic at the moment. But there is another way of relating. And so I think that that's what our brain kind of forces on us, and that philosophers kind of have to get real and accept the reality, and that their attempts at metaphysics and ontology are going to have to reflect the reality of our understanding.
Thanks for that, Anthony. Very concise and informative. Before I let you go, if you'd just like to take this opportunity to mention your research coming up, what are your areas of interest, what papers you've got coming out, any books planned for your work in this area?
So the most important paper, which is kind of like an overview of this whole thing, is about to come out in the first volume of Oxford Studies in Experimental Philosophy, edited by Joshua Knobe, Tanya Lombroso, and Sean Nichols. And the paper is called A Scientific Case for Conceptual Dualism, The Problem of Consciousness and the Opposing Domains Hypothesis. And so that really covers this. If you are curious about what I was saying about ethics and how I see an important way of going forward as bridging between an experiential understanding of people and a scientific account of what's going on with them, I'm just in the process of editing a foreword for a book that will be available soon on Amazon called Your Brain on Porn, Internet Pornography, and the Emerging Science of Addiction. And the foreword is called Neuroscience, the Internet, and the Good Life. And it's all about how the danger of technology is it makes us impersonal, and that pornography is perhaps the premier example of this, because it's taking our motivation to engage in the most personal type of contact, the most personal, most intimate, most trusting type of contact. And instead, it's motivating people to engage in wholly solitary and unproductive activity, whose name I will not say. So it turns out that, you know, kids are watching now this internet pornography from a very young age, and they are genuinely getting hooked, and it's affecting their lives in horrible ways. There are late adolescents right now, about there is 50% or more of both males and females have clinical sexual problems. This is because watching a lot of pornography tends to give you either with the males erectile dysfunction, so that you can only get an erection for pornography but not for a real person, or for females lowers arousal, reduces pleasure. It's also shaping how people are engaging in sex. It's making it more depersonalized even when it is personal. So it's having a big influence on us. But I think why this foreword and the book reflects this conflict I'm talking about is because the book contains very vivid personal reports of people who have become hooked on internet pornography and then given it up, and how their life has changed since they've given it up. And there's also a lot of coverage, both in my foreword and in the book, of what's happening in the brain and what the science behind this is. So this is actually a melding between an experiential and a scientific perspective, and I think it's one that's actually a very important ethical issue right now.